it's interesting to look at the attitude of Elon Musk. Don't like to mention capitalist names very often, but recently he was there's a dispute in Sweden relating to union recognition in one of this Tesla factory. Yeah, because this company does not like trade union activity. They don't. I'm sure we've seen references to this fellow in the Standard before, quite recently. But they just announced recently in the Global Times, which is Chinese Communist Party mouthpiece in English. That Tesla is just about to make some massive investments in China. So, you know, it's when we come across people that claim that China's socialist, this is the sort of example of if it's so inviting to someone like Tesla in comparison with Sweden, then what does that tell you about democracy? I'm just trying to give some sort of real life examples rather than we're going into some deep theory about whether China, about what the situation is in China. And I notice the text that you mentioned about what's it called, The East Is Still Red, which is apparently whether it's supported by the Morning Star or not. They've given it a pretty glowing review. It's actually for sale via the Morning Star website. So you would imagine that they obviously support this idea that China is a socialist society. Well, the headline on the Morning Star website is "For Peace and Socialism," and there's a really interesting article in a very recent Global Times, which talks about China's Z-10ME attack helicopter, which makes its overseas debut at the Singapore Air Show. So what these people are doing, these people that love peace and socialism at the Morning Star, are promoting a society which is taking this weaponry, which, by the way, includes Earth fragmentation missiles, which are quite plainly intended to splinter above the heads of human beings and kill them. And this is supposedly some peace-loving some sort of peace-loving society. It quite plainly isn't. Right. Okay. So those are just two specific examples that I think we could just chuck at people who say, yeah, China's socialist. And of course, I'll leave it at that for the minute. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Glad you read the Morning Star.
No, I don't. It occurred in a meeting where it got mentioned in another meeting. Yeah.
One observation I make there is that you talk about Musk not liking trade unions. They've actually got trade unions in China, or there's one big trade union, if you like, which actually doesn't seem to be controlled by the state, although no doubt the state's sort of got a BDI on it. It's called the All China Federation of Trade Unions. That's the one official trade union, and people belong to sort of different sort of bits of it according to their... according to their occupation. It seems relatively independent in the sense that, you know, it does seem to assist workers in protesting or taking sort of action where necessary and so on. If it became very bad, if it became very dire, to use that word, perhaps the state would intervene and dissolve it or something like that. But it does exist. It is there. And of course, if I'm not mistaken, trade unions existed in Soviet Russia as well. So, whether Elon Musk likes it or not, if he goes to invest in China, he will find there are trade unions there that workers can join, can be members of. Okay, a couple of other... Paddy, over to you.
Thanks for that, Howard. I thought that was really interesting. You covered a lot of ground there. You mentioned early on, just out of curiosity, you mentioned a journalist who couldn't get a visa for China, and I wondered if it was Alice Su from The Economist, because she used to be the Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, and then she basically got booted out of the country, and so now she's lurking in Taiwan for The Economist, and she's told this same story that you just told. So I don't know if you know that The Economist has this kind of podcast called Drum Tower, which is, you know, on China, but you sort of listen to it and you think, well, it's a lot of cultural gossip, really. It's not really hard hitting, but of course, well, the Beijing bureau chief, David Rennie, presumably has to tread quite carefully on what he can get away with saying. So there is quite a lot on the culture. It is really interesting, as long as you don't expect it to be really sort of politically hard-hitting, but it does tell you a lot about what's going on there. I mean, for example, this thing about Xi's war on women, you know, they're having to sort of row back on, you know, decades of one-child policy, and now we're trying to persuade women to have more kids. But given the really uncertain property situation, which they point out that in China, people save about 30% of their money they put into property, compared to around about 8% in 8 to 12% in most other Western countries. So it's 30% of the economy is tied up with property. And so you've got this kind of really alarming situation from the CCP's point of view. But they also point out that it's quite interesting what The Economist's argument about this is. They make absolutely no bones about China being capitalist. None at all. There's no question. And they also say, which is, I think, is quite interesting, is they say that after China has had this explosive, you know, tiger growth over the last 30 years, that was always going to be unsustainable. It was always going to top out. And what it's now doing is it's aligning with mature global capitalism, including, and The Economist doesn't make any bones about this either, the boom and slump business cycle. That's normal capitalism from The Economist's point of view, you know, or any realist's point of view. And I just think it's quite interesting that, you know, one of Marx's biggest criticisms against capitalism was the boom and slump cycle, which he said was inevitable and unavoidable. And you find the journalists at The Economist just think the same thing. And they're saying, you know, China's problem now is that it's now having to confront a boom and slump cycle that it's never had to deal with before. The CCP's way of dealing with this in the last 10 years has been to throw money at the problem, vast amounts of money, which they now understand is not sustainable. So they're massively cutting back on Belt and Road investments. They've introduced the three red line policy, which has caused Evergrande collapse. And they've also defunded a huge number of industry sectors, causing, you know, unemployment and causing businesses to collapse. The only thing they're really putting money into is big tech, high-end tech companies, you know, that deal with things like AI, surveillance, military equipment, that sort of thing. That's the only thing they're really putting money into. So I think it's really fascinating what you've said about it. And, you know, from the capitalist point of view, there's a huge amount of money tied up in China, investments. But also from our point of view, it's like this is a huge sort of part of the world that's supposedly socialist, supposedly been spoon-fed Marxism from primary school, and yet they live in this country which, well, I think I would describe it as capitalism with totalitarian characteristics, you know. And how sustainable is it to have this one-party dictatorship when you've got 14% youth unemployment, you've got people who can't afford to buy or have bought houses that haven't been built yet and quite possibly won't ever get built, who've sunk huge amounts of money into property, who can't afford to have kids because they can't afford property, and yet are being, you know, as far as the women are concerned, are being made to feel guilty because they're not having more kids. The whole thing seems like a car crash. It does to me, and it does seem to be to The Economist and to other articles I read about this. So I think a very timely talk. So thanks. So I've rambled on. Sorry about that. Thanks, Al Howard.
That's okay, buddy. Thanks very much for that. But there's just to sort of tease this out a little bit, though, because on the one hand, what you're saying is that, and according to The Economist, what's happening in China is what happens in other capitalist countries. Basically, they have boom, slump, etc. China's falling into line with other capitalist countries in not being able to have permanently high growth rates and so on. So what's the difference? On the other hand, you're saying that it's sort of heading for a car crash, but is it heading for a car crash any more than the West, where there's the same kind of thing happens as well? You see, the problem I see in this is that we've always taken the view that in order for capitalism to sort of develop effectively in its own terms, it needs a sort of relatively democratic system, free exchange of ideas, etc., in order for investment to take place effectively, for innovation and so on. And without that, any country that tries to develop capitalism without that, as the Soviet Union did, for example, will tend to fall behind. Now, is China developing in the same way as the West without that? If it is, it throws our sort of take on this into disarray, because, of course, we need democratic institutions to develop in countries in order for socialist ideas, which then develop themselves, to be actually put into practice via elections and so on. So, I see a bit of a problem here anyway with, in ways of comparing China totalitarian regimes like capitalism regimes, as you say, like China, to sort of the non-totalitarian regimes in the West. Anyway, we can talk a little bit more about that perhaps a little bit later. Shall we go on to Adam now? Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to follow up something that Steve said about the attitude of the Morning Star to China. You know, Howard, you recommended that book on the history of the Communist Party by Robert Griffiths, who is the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Britain, which is closely linked to the Morning Star.
I recommended that you read it.
the book you recommended, I read it, and one thing that did surprise me is that there's some sort of cryptic references to what's going on in China being misrepresented, and I think in fact I think you mentioned it in your talk, a journalist on the Morning Star who wrote a book favorable to China. I think that is what the Communist Party of Britain think should be introduced in this country. I mean, they've got the theory they inherited from the old Communist Party, but what we've got in Britain is state monopoly capitalism, and they want an alliance of all the people to end this and introduce what in effect will be non-state or state non-monopoly capitalism. And I think it's, you know, they're saying this has been, or implying this exists already in China. So you have a large state-controlled sector, but you also have a not negligible private sector, but they're not in control of things. So, when the Morning Star and then the Communist Party of Britain talk about socialism, the model is no longer the old USSR. It's modern present day China. The other thing I notice in this book is that Griffiths refers to their ideology, you know, of the Communist Party of Britain, you know, not just as Marxism as they used to, but as Marxism-Leninism, which, you know, which as we know, certainly is associated with people that support China. Even, you know, we've got plenty of Communist Party of Britain's Marxist-Leninist, Communist Party of Britain, Marxist-Leninist. But of course, those Marxist-Leninists, in inverted commas, of course, are Maoists, but the, you know, the Morning Star and the Communist Party of Britain appear to be, you know, pro-Chinese, but not pro-Mao. But that point would have probably come, you know, better immediately after Steve's. Yep. Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Adam. Okay. Interesting. Brian, would you like to say a word?
Yes. Yes. I think I would bear out your analysis in regards to the decrease in growth in China and the consequences of that, the possible consequences of that, is that surveillance of the Chinese population has increased massively through the use of CCTV, etc., and also the control over employment. You know, if they find some person is very critical of the Communist Party and what's occurred in China, etc., they'll try their best to ensure that for them, a change of employment or even a change of location is very difficult to obtain. Right. Now, another thing that's brought up and is in the chat as well by Jane, right, who's here, and she turns around and says, she obviously sees China as an actual fascist, the state's control of private capital, repression of workers, and nationalism, and attacks on ethnic minorities, and of course, family policy. Well, that's all occurring, in China. And yes, that does point the finger at a fascist regime in regards to the control and repression of authoritarianism, etc., is getting worse in China. And obviously, if that's the case, you know, the Chinese Communist Party are very concerned that the degrowth and the turnover on the demographic change in China has taken place, and the lack of marriage and increase in population, and especially for females, etc., right, is turning on them. You know, capitalism in effect is kicking them in the teeth, right, you know, really sharp and ferocious, if you like. And there is a big possibility that things will get so bad in China that the population will turn on them and turf out the Communist Party. That is a possibility, you know. We've seen it in the past where the ruling elite can maintain repression for so long, but to sustain it over and over and over again for decades is very, very unlikely. You know, eventually, you know, it will turn down, as we see it in East Germany, which is a very repressive regime, you know, and high surveillance on the population, right? Came a time, you know, that they just got kicked in the teeth and booted out. And there you go. I don't know what you make of it anyway. A good talk, Howard. Very good talk.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for drawing my attention to Jane's comment in the chat. Sorry, I hadn't seen it. Just a quick word about that. In case there are people who can't see the chat, I'll just read what Jane's put in the chat. She says, shouldn't we see China as actually fascist? the state's control of private capital, repression of workers, and nationalism, and attacks on ethnic minorities, and of course, family policy. Well, yeah, I mean, what does fascist mean? It means these days what you want it to mean, but, you know, that kind of thing, you know, sums up a regime which in the past we certainly would have called fascist pretty well. Yeah, entirely cogent comment there, I would say. Yeah, fine. Right, Paul now. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I just want to begin by saying some things about to do with a book which I've been reading and started writing a review of. It's called The Crisis of Democratic Capitalism by Martin Wolf, who writes for the Financial Times. The book's not about China, but he mentions China a bit as one of the alternatives to democratic capitalism. And he calls it, for instance, despotic capitalism. And he also says that, you can find the other quote, he also says that China is a competitive economy under monopoly politics. But another point I wanted to make is something which hasn't come up before, is that he says that in China, GDP per head is extremely low. And he claims, for instance, that it's still less than one output per head. Is still less than that of the US. So he says that there's still a great space for it to grow, very quick for it to grow. I'm not quite sure how you measure those things, but that's one possibility, I think. Other point I wanted to make is that a few years ago, I did an article for The Standard on Chinese Marxism, in quotes, and I tried to find out precisely what they mean when they say that in China, that China is Marxist. And it's very hard to find anything, just a load of waffle about Mao Zedong thought and Deng Xiaoping's ideas and so on. And, you know, they don't even really try to pretend, or didn't then, to try to pretend that China was in any way Marxist. I don't know if things have changed since, but it wasn't even, you know, pretend or anything else, you know. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, it still continues, this constant reference to Marxism. Not Marxist-Leninist, by the way, that somebody mentioned a couple of minutes ago. Very little reference to Lenin, but everywhere you look in Chinese government propaganda, there's reference to Marx and Marxism. I've got in front of me, actually, a little piece from a publication called China Daily, which it's a government propaganda sheet which is published every day, the author of this particular piece is, it says, a professor of Marxist theory at the party school of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China, and it's from the 26th of December 2023. His name is Li Min. I won't read that, well, it's not very long anyway, but I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read a few sentences and you'll see the kind of thing I mean. It is clear that taking Marxism as the guide and constantly adopting Marxism to the Chinese context and the needs of the times are the principal reason for the success and continuing development of the cause of the party and the country. The success of the party could also be attributed to the party's endless efforts to adapt Marxism to the Chinese context and the needs of the times. For more than 100 years, the party has been integrating Marxism to its major theories and guiding thoughts, and constantly adapting Marxism to the Chinese context and the needs of the times, thereby facilitating the fine achievements of civilization and using the scientific theory of Marxism as a guide to its practices. It's Marxism, Marxism, Marxism. All of, obviously, it's empty rhetoric, we know, but there's still, and Xi Jinping still really fixed on these words, Marx and Marxism. As I say, don't seem to want to sort of have much to do with Lenin. Maybe there are publications where Lenin is mentioned as well, and it's Marxism, Leninism, but on the whole, it's Marxism, Marxism. Okay. Load of waffle, as somebody just said. Yes, it is. Right, Steve, over to you.
Yeah, waffle indeed, isn't it? I mean, when you if you take away the idea that that modern socialism can only come about because it's the only alternative. It's the only way that workers can take any control of the industrial resources, which is not the case in a backward country like China was in 1948. Then it's this absolute drivel as far as writings of Marx are concerned. You put me off a bit there, Howard. Not your fault. Just wanted to add to what I said before, in relation to this idea of can dictatorship survive in China when it's got this capitalist economy. The one thing that the capitalists can't stand is the lack of information. A lack of accurate information, and you mentioned it yourself. The fact that they suppressed the unemployment figures for youngsters, I think it's 16 to 24, isn't it, something like that. As soon as it started looking at looking bad on the system for the system, and this is reading. Stuff that you see on the internet from somebody like the Financial Times or the Economist, you find these people reporting that on capitalists' behalf or investors' behalf that they're very wary of they're unable to they're unable to carry out due prudence, I think it's called, isn't it, or something like that, before they buy any shares. So this is the one thing that the capitalist class cannot do. They cannot live with false economic data, and this is something that's a big problem for the chart in a dictatorship, because there's so many vested interests that want to keep the data cloudy. So that's one of the reasons that I would suggest that eventually that the capitalist class will throw this lot out. Also, I think they will throw this lot out because what it seems to occur. For example, there seems to be a huge amount of corruption in China, which we've seen some references to this in the Western press, and this is acting like the leech, like the capitalist class, does not want another leech on its back because it affects its bottom line, and that's another reason that they want to get shut of a dictatorship. Okay, that's that.
Thanks, Steve. Almost second nature in these regimes for those at the top to just deny anything that's inconvenient to them, no matter how obvious a truth we're looking at. You've just said that sooner or later the capitalist class will throw them out. Yeah, if we compare this with what happened in the Soviet Union, I mean, the party had been saying for years that the Soviet Union, state capitalist Soviet Union could not last forever. Something would happen to sort of bring it down. And everybody else was saying it's fixed, it's there, you can't change it. Well, the party was right. Everyone else was wrong, basically. But how did it happen? It didn't happen by a sort of mass revolt of the people. It happened by a sort of discontent at the top, didn't it? It happened the sort of ruling clique changing its policy in ways they thought would be popular and were popular at the time. And exactly the same kind of thing, if the Chinese regime is to change, is likely to happen in China. It won't be a mass revolt by the populace. It will be sort of adjustments at the top. And different people will sort of come to take power, et cetera, et cetera, and want to reorganize things, and they'll find that it's popular to do so. And it's much more like the change will come about in that way, my view anyway, than sort of, if you like, directly from below. As Rucker says, sort of, time will tell. But it's more likely, in my view, for the powers that be themselves to sort of, you know, see what's in the interest of the capitalist system in China as a whole, than to sort of want to simply blindly keep autocratic control. Okay,
Can I just clarify something, Howard? I didn't say that this is definitely going to happen. I'm just suggesting that this is one reason why there's going to be capitalist opposition to what to the system. I'm not sure that I fully agree with what you just said, but anyway, I just wanted to make my position clear. Sorry about that. Thank you.
Fine. That's fine, Steve. Okay. Paddy?
Thanks. That was quite interesting what you and Steve just said, because I was thinking, there's probably quite a lot of capitalist opposition to Putin in Russia at the moment, but, you know, they seem to express their particular opposition by accidentally falling out of top story windows. So just how much the capitalist class in China is going to be able to express them their opposition is a moot point. I mean, you remember the story of Jack Ma, the billionaire boss of I've forgotten what it's called, the Chinese Amazon, the Alibaba, wasn't it? He basically disappeared for 6 months after shooting off his mouth in public several times. He just disappeared, like that Chinese tennis player also did. She disappeared for about 2 years, and when Jack Ma came back into the public eye, he was noticeably chastened and unwilling to discuss politics. So, you know, I think Xi and his cronies have got an absolute stranglehold on China at the moment. And I think the reason why they've got that is because they're terrified of a Berlin Wall style sort of implosion. You know, you said, Howard, that, you know, the Berlin Wall collapse all came from the top, and a lot of it did, but a lot of it was from underneath as well. I mean, the pressure was there from underneath as well, I think. And I think that the powers that be in China are terrified of this, a similar sort of thing happening. So what are they doing? They're doing what dictators always do. They're doubling down on repression. And but this is at a time when, and I also wanted to just take up something else that you said in reply to me earlier about, just because they're aligning with, or possibly aligning with, global capitalism doesn't automatically follow that they're going to have a giant crash. But I think maybe I didn't quite make my point clear enough. Is what I was trying to say was that the last 30 years in China has been it's very like what happened in the tiger economies in the 90s, where what that basically was a credit bubble. You know, Western firms and banks were investing, lending them huge amounts of money, they couldn't sort of keep up with it. You know, their production couldn't keep pace, and the whole thing sort of collapsed in a heap. And you've got this similar sort of overvaluation in the Chinese economy, most particularly with property, where you had the price of a house in Shenzhen on the Pearl River cost more than apartments in Paris or London or New York. It was ridiculous prices in a country where their wages are about a fifth of what they are in most advanced capitalist countries. So crazy overvaluation in the property market, which I also mentioned is 30% of their economy, not, you know, 8 or 10%. I think that they are absolutely, you know, terrified of a meltdown. You know, hence the doubling down on repression. But I mean, that process, you know, that is, it seems to me, most likely to lead to a kind of explosive situation, you know, kicking off. I mean, just like Steve, you know, I'm not saying that will happen. I'm just saying that's another possibility. But I think it's quite a serious possibility at the moment, the way things are. Thank you.
Yeah, interesting, Paddy. It's difficult to know where it will come from if it comes. Can I just pass over to Adam now?
Yeah, to join in this debate as to how the present system in China might end. I think you know the parallel has been drawn with what happened in the old USSR, but it wasn't the private capitalists in Russia who overthrew the system there, because there weren't many of them. In fact, what happened was the opposite, wasn't it? The members of the ruling elite, the nomenclature, almost literally divided up the state property amongst themselves and converted themselves into capitalists. I mean, I don't know whether that will happen in China or not, but I think China successfully done what the previous Russian state capitalists ruling class failed to do. They managed to manage the transition away from strict centralized type of state capitalism towards a more market oriented system without losing power. So they're still in political control, while the old Communist Party nomenclature in Russia, well, they converted themselves into private capitalists. But I mean, the Communist Party in Russia still exists. I think it's the main opposition, in fact, to our friend Putin. I think if you go back into long way back into history, in the 18th century, China was a lot more economically developed part of the world, than was Western Europe. But they had a merchant class which could have converted itself into a capitalist class and introduced capitalism in China. It didn't happen. It didn't happen because of the power of the emperor, the bureaucratic system that they had there. So if history is going to repeat itself, I don't think that the private capitalist class in China is going to take initiative to overthrow the government. What would happen if there was some sort of popular uprising? I don't know. I mean, maybe China would break up into separate warlords and things like it did between the last two world wars. But it wouldn't necessarily be anything of an advantage to us, necessarily to advantage to us. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Adam. Yeah, very difficult to know if change does come, exactly where it's going to come from. Is it going to come from below? Is it going to come from the capitalist class? Is it going to come from members of the ruling class, members of the ruling bureaucratic class? Quite hard to know. I mean, if you think about Eastern Europe, I mean, in Russia, it came mainly from above, didn't it? Key figures, if you like, in the government sort of precipitated it. Whereas in the satellite states, Poland, East Germany, and so on, a lot of it came from below. So difficult to know, impossible to predict, obviously. But it's hard to imagine that in the relatively near future, there isn't going to be some change, some significant change. We can only hope it's the kind of change that, that benefits us in the sense that it allows a freer system in which our ideas can spread, can be permitted, in which we can actually talk about Marxism. And, we know exactly what it means, and so does everybody else. Are there any other comments anybody would like to make? Mike, you've got your hand up. Do speak.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for the talk, Howard. Yeah, very, very interesting. And Very thorough as well. And yeah, interesting discussion afterwards as well. It was just a quick question, really. You mentioned a couple of times about members of the peasant class in China. And I was just wondering how the peasant class sort of fits in with the history of the sort of development of capitalism in China. Yeah, I was just wondering if you could maybe expand a bit on that, if that's okay. Yeah, thank you.
I have to confess, it's not something I know a lot about, Mike. I suppose my main take on the peasantry in China is that millions of them have been sort of been forced under sort of threat under pressure of poverty to emigrate to these to move to these towns and do these jobs that are poorly paid. I suspect a lot of the so-called platform jobs, the employment that we call gig employment, is done by people who move from all their family and move from the countryside to live in the towns. Obviously, it's still a massive agricultural country as well, China, and will continue to be so for a long time. And a lot of that agriculture is still very primitive, but nevertheless, there's been this enormous, absolutely enormous shift from country to town in China, which can only continue into the foreseeable future. I can't really say much else, Mike, because it's not something I know that much about. I don't know whether anybody else does. Brian's got his hand up. Maybe Brian does.
Yeah, I know a little bit. What occurred in regards to the development of the peasant classes, they have actually become the industrial, part of the Industrial Reserve Army, right? Yes, people are emigrated to the cities and try to get work there, but a lot of them, because they can't get visas, it's illegal work. And once they found out, they turned back to the peasant economy. Right, but it continues, and pretty well. It's getting that sort of integration is getting overwhelmed now, right? Loads and loads of the peasant class going towards the city. And like I said, they are now a part of the Industrial Reserve Army, of unemployed working class as and when, or employed working class as and when the capitalist system requires them. That's about it.
Thanks, Brian. Mike, have we got you again?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I suppose that maybe isn't sort of quite what I was getting at. I was just wondering what differentiates members of the peasant class from being the those at sort of the bottom of the working class, given that, I mean, I get that this isn't really, my area of expertise at all, but yeah, I get that the economy in China is still sort of structured in a way that's different from the West, but I haven't quite got how it still manages to sort of maintain that aspect of previous societies by having a peasant class. I wonder how that is, and what makes what doesn't make the members of the working class, and presumably those who are sort of in poverty or destitute almost, and have to rely on very transient work that would exist in sort of other countries that we wouldn't necessarily call a peasant class. So yeah, again, forgive me ignorance, but maybe you could again, apologies, Howard, if it isn't really your specialist subject, Brian maybe, or someone else. Yeah, maybe sort of explain a bit about the relationship between the peasantry and the working class. Yeah, cheers. Thanks.
I think it's something that I'll have to read up on as well, Mike. Sorry about that. It's not something that I can say I've given any particular thought to in preparing this talk, but it's a good question. It's a very good question indeed. Yeah, yeah. Steve, hopefully you know something about this. Are you there, Steve? You've got your hand up.
Sorry, I'll just plug in my headset back in. Right, I'm afraid I missed Mike's first question, but I mean, let's let's be clear about what we should mean when we're talking about peasants, and that is people with an independent access to production, which is what the working class doesn't have. Now, I'm not actually sure whether you're still able to refer to a peasant class in China, or whether we've now, whether they've entirely collectivised and turned these people into wage workers. If so, they're members of the working class because they've been separated from the means of production. I mean, that's the bog standard answer as to what constitutes a peasant. Someone who is not entirely dependent on capital and on selling the labour power to a capitalist. If anybody wants to refine that, fine. I mean, but perhaps if we could find out that sort of information about the Chinese economy now, or at least trustworthy statistics. Yeah, that's it.
Just to say, I've just remembered that I read something recently about farmers' cooperatives in China, about the fact that very many farmers in China were involved in so-called farmers' cooperatives, and therefore, which were sort of state institutions, really. So they weren't sort of self-employed as the peasant class would have been in the past in a particular way. And what I read about farmers' cooperatives is that they're a fraud and a failure, that there's absolutely massive corruption. And of research that somebody did into alleged cooperatives in China, only two were found as genuine functioning cooperatives. The rest weren't cooperatives to begin with, but they benefited, if I can use that word, from hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies. These subsidies had largely funded local elites rather than any of the farmers themselves. So this is part of the sort of massive corruption that existed enormously in China after Mao disappeared. And is perhaps less prevalent now, but still seems to exist in the form of these false cooperatives, these fake cooperatives, which apparently exist in abundance in China. John, do speak now. Over to you, John.
Yes, I just wanted to say that the peasant class, such as it still remains, is often in the process of becoming workers. Surprise, surprise. So in Europe, the peasant class gradually became workers by being forced to move into the cities, the towns and cities, and so on. And a similar kind of thing has happened in China. But what you also had was a sort of incomplete assimilation into a new class of people who, for example, even in France and Germany, who still have a little bit of land, but not enough to really survive on. Consequently, their main activity, or some of their activity, is that of wage slavery. So these are people you could say are in a sort of transitory state. And I suspect that a similar thing is happening in China. I know a lot of people have been forced to move into the cities, like someone says earlier, and stuff like that. So I think that's the situation. And the other thing is the common agricultural policy. That was in part to deal with these remnants of feudalism, you might say, that they had in France, and particularly more France than in Germany, but also in parts of Germany. And Britain didn't really have much of a class like that, or remnants of a class like that. But Germany and France had more of that. And so, you know, there were elements of the common agricultural policy that sort of facilitated that part of the economy. So I don't know if that's you know, it's probably a lot more detailed than obviously I've said there. But no, that's the situation, I think, on the peasantry. Most places, it's in the process of becoming another class, or perhaps not in most places, but in a lot of places that are developing, such as in China and places that are developing capitalism more. That's something that's happening. There's lots of parts of the world where people are just staying peasants because capitalism hasn't really, you know, bothered too much about that part of the world yet. But where capitalism does intrude, of course, it will force people to change. And, of course, that change, as we know, is quite often to their detriment. But that's capitalism for you, whether it's capitalism with fascist characteristics, capitalism with Chinese characteristics, or Germany with national socialist characteristics. There's all sorts of strange use of language that's common to all of these regimes. The so-called national socialists in Germany 90 years ago, we called it socialism for idiots. Not, of course, when we were in Germany. Yeah, these semantic notions, there's just a whole load of drivel talked. Anyway, I've drifted off the subject of the peasantry, so I just had a small thing to say about the peasantry and the situation that they're in. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Jane's put an observation in the chat, which is peasants and exiled Red Guards came to cities illegally and effectively created a black economy. Okay, that's interesting. Thanks for that, Jane. Right, we've hit 9 o'clock. In fact, it's 4 minutes past nine. Officially, we finish at nine. We can go on longer if there are people have got further comments to make. But nobody has got their hand up at the moment. So perfectly happy to sort of call it a day now and go and have a cup of tea or whatever we do after these talks. Perhaps we can advertise next Friday's meeting before we leave. Adam, do you know off the top of your head what's next Friday?
I know what the topic is. It's have you heard the news or but the problem is I haven't found anybody to do it yet. So if there's anybody here that wants to volunteer to do it. Anyway, I've got a week to persuade somebody to do it. Otherwise, I have to do it myself. But I think I can find somebody else to do it. But that's what one of our general discussions on the news. I'm trying to make these the first one of the month because the people sometimes get the standard late and might not know about them. Anyway, that's what it is. It's the 1st of March, isn't it? Is it?
Yeah, that's right. 1st of March. Okay.
Oh, well, it's a Welsh day. We'll have somebody speaking in Siarad Cymraeg, shall we?
Okay. Why not, yeah?
Well, Brian can do it in Welsh. Yep.
Thanks.
Okay.
All right, fine. Steve, you got your hand up?
Yeah, just a query, Howard. That thing that you were referring to about these pseudo-collective farms, could you let people have a reference for it? That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Not necessarily no, but...
Okay, yes, it was a paper about dysfunctional and fake forest cooperatives in China. But, I can send round. All right. Right, thank you all very much for listening and participating, and hopefully see you all next week. Okay.
Thanks,
Thanks very much, Howard.
All right.